Welcome to Ideasphere with Professor Susan D. Carl, Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1915.
Looks like they were tilting at windmills because there's no electoral power. There was no basis for believing that they could make change at a federal legislative level, but they did it anyway just because they felt it was the right thing to do. So I think they were really trying to bring about what many people call the second Reconstruction. They see the civil rights legislation of the 1960s as a second Reconstruction. And I think even back in the early 20th century, people were already looking towards that as something that they wanted to ultimately happen.
The NAACP and the National Urban League were founded over 100 years ago. Since their inception, they've been viewed as the vanguard for national civil rights in American history. But these two flagship institutions were not the first important national organizations devoted to advancing the cause of racial justice. There were earlier groups, the National Afro-American League, the National Afro-American Council, the National Association of Colored Women, and the Niagara Movement, who set the wheels in motion. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Susan D. Carl. Her new book, Defining the Struggle, explores these forerunner organizations, the groups from the early 20th century that have largely been forgotten. Ms. Carl teaches legal ethics, anti-discrimination law, labor and employment law, and torts at American University Washington College of Law. Ms. Carl joins me for this program. Thanks so much for taking this time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
With your work, and I'm talking about Defining the Struggle, you choose the years between 1880 and 1915 so pivotal to the growth of equality that led to the civil rights movement for blacks. But in reality, the troubles started shortly after the 13th Amendment, the appeasing of the South through the Reconstruction efforts, and the Supreme Court just undermined the efforts that were made during the Civil War, leaving blacks much worse off in the Jim Crow era that occurred before and around 1880 than they were in slavery.
Right. Well, so there's my book picks up right around 1880, which is after the end of Reconstruction. So there's a period after the end of slavery where the national government, at least, is saying we have to do something to make amends for the horrible crime of slavery. We have freed former enslaved people, and now we need to try to bring them to full citizenship rights. So there's some effort during the Reconstruction era to do that, though, as you're pointing out, there, this is, of course, still a period of lots of brutal violence and lots of terrible things happening to formerly enslaved people. But at least there's some commitment by the national government, or it appears there will be. And then by 1880, that's really completely vanished. And you're pointing to the court as one of the institutions that's failing to fulfill the promise of the 13th Amendment and also the 14th and 15th Amendments, which are passed at the same time. So the U.S. Supreme Court, through a series of cases, is basically trying to narrow the interpretation and disregard the existence of the 14th, 15th, and 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments by saying things like in one important case in 1883 called the Civil Rights Cases, the court says, which is examining whether the 13th Amendment's prohibition against the badges and incidents of slavery, whether that covers segregation on streetcars, trains, and in places of public accommodation. And the court says, oh, segregation isn't really connected with this history of slavery. It's just a social practice. And really, we as the court can't reach those kinds of matters between citizens about how they prefer to live their lives or how they prefer to socialize or whatever. So in doing so, the court is really shrinks the meaning and the impulses behind the Reconstruction era amendments and sends a signal that it's fine to introduce Jim Crow, that the court's not going to get in the way, and that segregating people by race in public accommodations is not going to be something that it's going to try to invalidate or cast criticism on. So that's one of the ways. There are a lot of other ways as well, but that's one of the ways in which the country really begins this massive backsliding on race relations, and we head into what's called the Nadir period with the rise of Jim Crow and the enactment of many, many laws and statutes that discriminate on the basis of race, including in really fundamental political rights like voting rights and that kind of thing.
Your work is coming out at such an important time, very pivotal, because we're starting to realize, at least admit, I should say, our past, our involvement with Black civil rights and the enslavement of a people for hundreds of years, how that has evolved. So now that we are becoming more aware of what actually happened there, it seems that your material then is that much more important because we can look at the growth of these democratic organizations that led to the NAACP.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to do with this project, is to really say we have a pretty good historical awareness of the 20th century civil rights movement, especially, you know, people who are interested in that range of issues. But there's a period before the founding of the NAACP, which happened in 1910, so that period between the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of launching of this major organization that's going to have, play a major role through the 20th century, we don't remember so much about that period. But as I try to uncover in the research that I did, there's really a lot of the ideas that end up almost being taken for granted by the time the NAACP is founded. Those ideas are really being tested and developed in this earlier period that we don't pay too much attention to now. So I wanted to revive the voices and the work and the activism that was going on there too.
What was interesting to find out, though, in the middle of all this work, and let's go back to the near turn of the century, the African American League that came out of the first organizing for equal protection, let's say. I don't know if I'm using the proper phrase there. But this organization led to the NAACP, but it's surprising to me that there was so much discord, disagreement between the conservatives and the accommodationists, as they were called.
Right. Well, I actually think conflict can be a very fruitful way of testing ideas. And there was a lot of conflict. So there was one group, and this conflict really came to loggerheads in the Afro-American Council, which is the organization that comes along after the Afro-American League. So there are the group called the Accommodationists, which are affiliated with Booker T. Washington, who at least publicly is saying we should accommodate white prejudice. We shouldn't be militant about civil rights. We should work on economic advancement, and then civil rights issues will catch up with, you know, eventually catch up. That's what he would say publicly, though privately he had a very different view. Mm-hmm. But there's that group of activists, and then there's another group that's far more militant and far more radical, and they're both want to be much more outspoken about civil rights issues, but they also have a different vision of what justice would look like in the long run. So they're much more interested in using democratic means to redistribute wealth, and they are interested in working in coalition with the labor movement. And so they have a different sort of general underlying sense of what justice will look like, what their ultimate vision of justice is. And they really clash within the Afro-American Council. And eventually they break off, the militants or radicals break off and form a new organization called the Niagara Movement. And that's the most immediate precursor to the NAACP.
I would, as looking at some of his own work and what you wrote about it, in that class would be Du Bois.
Yes. Du Bois is very important. He's at the beginning of what's going to end up being an amazingly long and important career as the primary spokesperson on race equality and social justice issues in the 20th century. And at this point, he's just starting to move towards his ideological commitments. And the Niagara movement is a place where he first struggles with these questions about who should lead the movement and what direction should that movement take and how should that movement work in coalition with other progressives who are interested on race justice issues. So he's really just starting to take on all of those ideas. And so it's very interesting to study the change in his thought over this period.
And then at the same time, we look back at Booker T. Washington. He's thought of very differently, but if you look at how he handled things at the turn of the century, he was considered much more of a divisive figure.
He was a divisive figure. And so it's always hard to pin him down because on the one hand, he is doing many very important and helpful things, especially around fundraising from white progressives. So he's raising just enormous amounts of money, not only for his institution called the Tuskegee Institute, which is doing vocational training for African-American young adults, but also for a lot of other organizations and colleges and universities as well who are working on educating African-Americans. So that's very important work, very important work, and he's very committed to it and very good at it. But at the same time, he's politically towards his opponents, towards people who want to do things a different way, he's really quite ruthless, and he really will go to any extent he can to ruin people's careers and even put them in physical danger if they're not going along with his agenda. So it's hard to really pin him down as, you know, in terms of his role in this period, because some of it was really productive and positive, and some of it was very negative and sort of held back some of the organizing that could have happened during the time.
In case you're just tuning in, the book is Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1910, Professor Susan D. Carl. You have a website or blog, tweet, anything else you would like to pass along right now?
I do. It's not quite open yet, but it will be any day now. So I'm working on a web page, and it will have various other resources and other suggestions about places to go to find out more about, you know, other books to read as well as mine. So that's in the works.
Okay. I'll have any web pages posted at Public Radio Exchange. If you're just tuning in and you missed the opening of this broadcast and it's live form, you can go to two sources to hear it at National Public Radio's home site under Podcasts and Ideasphere, or under Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. Again, Defining the Struggle, Susan D. Carl. Professor Carl, I want to go back to these juxtaposed figures, that is, Washington T. Booker and W.E.B. Du Bois, and look at the opposite side again, just finishing our discussion with Washington. But now we have a character who is referred to now in history as the talented 10th model. Can you describe that?
Yeah, so this is W.E. Du Bois in the late 19th century period of his thought. He espouses an idea called the talented 10th, which is his notion that in terms of strategy for, as he would put it, leading the race forward, the natural leaders are going to be those who are in the top 10th percentile in terms of their accomplishments and their abilities. And he sees that group as being composed of men mostly, and of being sort of successful professionals and educated persons. And so his idea about how to form the Niagara movement is to gather that group into an organization, an exclusive organization where you have to apply for membership and, you know, go through a membership vetting process. He wants to be very careful who he admits into the organization, and this will be the leadership organization. And what he learns through sort of the hard knocks of experience is that even that group isn't necessarily going to have the best ideas. They're not necessarily going to get along. They're not necessarily all going to agree on how to move forward. And so, in fact, there's some infighting in the Niagara movement. They're under, you know, attack from Booker T. Washington from outside. And the organization does some really interesting, important work, but it doesn't survive in the long run. And through that process, Du Bois really starts to understand that the movement that has to be built is a grassroots movement. Everybody who has the energy and commitment and courage to be involved should be invited to take part, and that it really has to be a working class movement, not just an organization of elite people. And so by the time he moves to the NAACP and takes over editing the Crisis, he's come to understand the nature of grassroots organizing in a way he didn't before. And so when you look at the covers of the Crisis magazine, which is the magazine that he edited, which articulates the vision for racial justice organizing, he would make a point of putting just ordinary people, ordinary sort of working class faces on the cover of the Crisis to say to people, this is your organization. This is an organization of people like you and not just an organization of the elite. So that's one of the ways that setting his thought in this period and seeing it change along with all of these other important historical changes that are going on is, you know, really interesting and really illuminating about the sources of the organizing strategy for what would eventually become a mass civil rights movement.
You're listening to Ideasphere with Professor Susan D. Carl, Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1915. I'm Guy Rothbun, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere with Professor Susan D. Carl, Defining the Struggle. Just before our break, you said a key word there, made up of men, these organizations such as the AAL and others. It was male-dominated. Eventually, the National Association of Colored Women's Social Network started, and it was a lot more pragmatic with the way it approached not only the labor movement, but also the political ideas that were evolving at that time.
Well, I think all of these organizations that weren't, except for the women's only organization, were somewhat male dominated, but the Afro-American League and the Afro-American Council had many very strong women leaders too. And T. Thomas Fortune, who founded the Afro-American League, was really a strong feminist. So, and the Afro-American Council had a rule that for the executive committee for each state, one of the three members had to be female. So I think those organizations really did foster women's leadership, and that women were very active and very important to both of those organizations. The one organization that really fell down on the gender equality front was, ironically enough, was the Niagara movement. And when that organization was founded, it was founded with a rule that prohibited women from membership or even attendance at its meetings. But women did not put up with that. And so within a year, Du Bois found himself having to negotiate with women about the terms of admitting women into the organization. But even after women were admitted into the Niagara movement, they were put in their own separate department, the women's department. So there's a little irony there, a little separate but equal within the Niagara movement. But women were incredibly important to organizing, to fundraising, to generating turnout, to building local branches. And one of the points that I want to make sure is clear about this period is the importance of women's efforts. And then there was, they also did, they organized in the National Colored Women's Clubs, which were all affiliate, local affiliates of a national organization, to do a lot of social reform work as well. And so their work really was a hybrid of civil rights work and social welfare work, and was also very important in developing ideas that would be important to the way that racial justice organizing proceeded in the 20th century.
Talking about the women who are involved or were involved with the various organizations, one pivotal figure and very interesting in our history of the NAACP was one of the founders. That's Mary White Ovington, who was, as you point out, probably the most committed of all the white women and men who were involved at that time. She had staying power.
She really did. I do think, and I write about her as she sort of exemplified this other stream of activism that came, that flowed into the founding of the NAACP, and that was white progressives who were involved in all kinds of different social reform activities. And many of those, sort of early founding circle of the NAACP ended up being involved for a little while and then moved on to other kinds of activities. But Mary White Ovington dedicated her life to the NAACP, and she worked there until she was in her 70s, really sometimes for no pay or very little pay. She lived in a, you know, a modest like boarding house room and gave her life to the organization. So she also, I think, is an important person to talk about in terms of talking about all of the different leaders who came together to found the movement.
A lot of folks not looking at the history might think of the civil rights movement that just cropped up in the 1960s. It was the political environment as well as the social environment that led to the marches and eventually the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In reality, looking back, it was all of these groups that eventually coalesced into the NAACP. How important were they to the work of civil rights in the 1960s?
Well, I think they're important precursors. And I think without understanding those very early seeds of ideas and how they eventually sort of played out later on, we have an incomplete understanding of how the civil rights movement got started and really any social movement gets started. So I do think there's a real difference between a mass movement, the kind of thing that happened in the 50s and 60s. That was a different phase, and that's where these ideas sort of caught light and really took off in a way that was unstoppable. So I'm not saying it was all the same throughout all of history, but I am saying that it's important to understand that those moments are follow from work that people are doing for decades beforehand, where that work doesn't sort of catch light or doesn't grow into something massive and unstoppable. But without that early work, it's harder to imagine that a mass movement can really get going in a way that actually leads to real change. So it's important to look back historically too.
Very important. And this is where I was going with that initial question. With the Supreme Court rulings during the Reconstruction era between 1867 and 1883, the reversal of that occurred with the victories of the NAACP and their Supreme Court activist work. There were so many cases, the most important of which may be considered the Elaine Massacre cases that were Moore versus Dempsey, but there were others involved as well. However, you look upon those as symbolic.
Well, some of the early cases, I wouldn't say that Moore v. Dempsey was symbolic, but the cases that I'm talking about, I really stopped the book after the first one or two of the very first cases. And one of them is U.S. v. Gwynne. And that's a case from 1915 that in its holding is a very important victory. It says that grandfather clauses are unconstitutional and illegal. And these, of course, are the clauses that prohibit African-American men from voting in throughout the South. They're built into Southern states' constitutions. So that's a very important victory in a way. The problem is, by that point, the grandfather clauses have already done their work. They've already wiped African Americans off the voting list. And then the Southern states, the state that was involved in U.S. v. Gwin is Oklahoma. And what Oklahoma does is it just changes the way that's going to cause disenfranchisement, and it introduces all white primaries. And the NAACP doesn't have a way to come back and doesn't have the resources to come back and challenge that as well. So sometimes you would get a victory, and the principle announced was an important principle, and it made people very excited and enthusiastic to see you could actually win one of these cases. But that doesn't mean that it transferred to real change on the ground. So that's what I mean by symbolic victories. But at the same time, I think it's really important to say that those were really important victories anyway.
Looking at those victories and the work of all these various organizations, the visionaries who were involved there, I can only imagine what they saw was the potential for maybe 100 years out, we'll have equality. Could they have anticipated 1964 and 65?
I think they were working. They were hoping for something like that. And I do spend some of the book talking about the way they were working on a federal legislative level. I mean, really, it looks today like they were tilting at windmills because there's no electoral power. There was no, no basis for believing that they could make change at a federal legislative level, but they did it anyway just because they felt it was the right thing to do. So I think they were really trying to bring about what many people call the second Reconstruction. They see the civil rights legislation of the 1960s as a second Reconstruction. And I think even back in the early 20th century, people were already looking towards that as something that they wanted to ultimately happen. But they were also despairing about how long it would take. And it's interesting, you bring up this question of how long, because sometimes Du Bois in The Crisis would write about, this could take us 100 years, this could take us 200 years, but we've got to do it anyway. So, yes, I think they understood it was going to be a very long haul.
What do you hope people take away from this history that you have written?
Well, I guess a lesson that I see for the conditions today, where many people, I think, are very depressed about the U.S. Supreme Court's invalidation of key parts of the Voting Rights Act, for example. But I think looking back with this long historical lens, it helps activists realize that even in periods where it looks like things are sliding backwards, the responses to those developments, the attempt to develop new ideas and continue to experiment, we can't know where that's all going to end up. And so it's important to just stay in the fight, stay in the struggle, and keep thinking creatively and hoping that, in the future there'll be other opportunities to kind of get in there and make change.
Well, Professor Carl, thank you so much for your time. This has really been a pleasure. I know there's a lot more we could talk about, but that covers it very well, I think.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I've greatly enjoyed it.
I have as well. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
My guest again, Susan D. Carl. Check out our website at definingthestruggle.com. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of PRX, Public Radio Exchange. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.